Welcome to Statewide Reports and Conversations from in and around Illinois. I'm Sean Crawford. Counselors answering the 988 Suicide and Crisis Lifeline hear from people dealing with mental health emergencies, but in some cases they also deal with verbal and sexual abuse from callers, and it's taking a toll on those who do the work. We'll have more on that story. With early voting getting underway, there are concerns about potential violence surrounding the election. Some of that's aimed at election officials. We'll hear more. Immigration is a key issue, and some misinformation is adding to tensions. We'll learn more about an effort to bring different communities together. Standardized testing in Illinois schools has undergone some changes. We'll learn how teachers are using that data. And have you ever thought about going vegan? An event in Springfield is getting chefs involved, creating vegan dishes. We'll hear those stories and more this hour on Statewide. This is Statewide. I'm Sean Crawford. The 988 Suicide Crisis Lifeline has received about 10 million calls and texts from people in mental health emergencies. Crisis counselors help people who may be on the cusp of taking their own life. But some counselors say they're also facing verbal and sexual abuse from those callers. Melissa Ellen reports some say there aren't enough protections in place. And a note to listeners, the story includes references to suicide and sexual misconduct.
What you're about to hear is a voicemail extension that Path Crisis Center in Bloomington, Illinois uses for abusive contacts who call 988.
At the 988 Suicide and Crisis Lifeline, our primary mission is to provide compassionate support and assistance to individuals facing challenging situations. We're informing you that your recent calls have been deemed inappropriate and potentially harassing.
CEO Adam Carter says the voicemail's goal is to prevent crisis counselors from having to take verbal attacks or sexually inappropriate conduct while on the line.
And so if that person is calling in back to back to back, we can then say, phone number 1234567 is on this list for the next 24 hours.
Carter says it's only a small step in solving a larger issue. Abusive contacts like these make up a tiny fraction of calls 988 receives. Millions of calls are often with people in desperate need of help, but the impact of these abusive calls can be detrimental. It's pushed some to quit the job. Crisis counselors at PATH and other call centers across the country say they need more protection.
I'm like having terrible flashbacks right now.
That's Lily Lance, who was a crisis counselor at PATH until recently. She describes some of the sexually abusive calls she dealt with.
They would sometimes say things like, "Your voice sounds so good right now. You're making me feel so good right now."
This on a lifeline where Lance helped other callers in the process of taking their own life.
Horrifying. Horrifying to hear that.
Crisis counselors cannot hang up until they've confirmed a caller is not at risk of harming themselves. They can't block a number ever because there's a chance even an abusive caller may need the emergency line in the future. Lance's response and the advice PATH gave her was to tell people their behavior was not appropriate and threatened to disconnect. But Lance says sexually abusive callers would trap the counselor.
It was especially difficult when they would say that they were suicidal. Whether that was true or not, I can't really say, but they were masturbating on the phone.
Lance works at one of the more than 200 crisis centers that receive 988 calls across the country. They're all managed by the nonprofit Vibrant Emotional Health. Vibrant has its own guidance on addressing abusive callers. It leaves implementation up to individual crisis centers. Shai Lewis, a VP at Vibrant, says that's intentional.
They have different makeups of different populations, different cultures, different expectations, different resources that are available. All of those things make them unique. There's, 200 different ways of doing things.
That's why PATH has its voicemail policy. But patchwork implementation across centers leaves other counselors feeling unsupported. In Colorado, six ex-counselors are suing the state's former 988 crisis center in federal court. They say they were never told to hang up if calls got abusive. The crisis center denies that. Call centers across the country have an incentive to find a solution, but they say it's hard without ramifications to deter abusers. Take the other emergency number, 911. They too get abusive calls. Rhonda Flegel, a director at a 911 communication center in Illinois, says it's not as frequent.
Because we can determine right where the caller is calling from or who's calling us, and they're not going to call if they know that we're going to find out.
And local and state laws make sure that there are legal ramifications for people who repeatedly misuse 911. None of that exists for 988. Still, former crisis counselor Lily Land says the abusive contacts never outshine the importance of the work 988 does. But
we're losing good people because of the emotional toll.
Lance says it's about sustainability of the crisis lifeline. For Side Effects Public Media, I'm Melissa Ellen.
This story is a collaboration between WGLT and Side Effects Public Media.
Tensions are running high during this political campaign, and election officials say they must stay vigilant. The Illinois State Board of Elections office in Springfield was evacuated last week after getting an envelope in the mail with a return address of USTEA. That stands for U.S. Traitor Elimination Army. Several states have received similar packages, and some have contained an unknown substance. A spokesperson for the Illinois State Board of Elections, Matt Dietrich, led a talk on election security and misinformation with the McLean County League of Women Voters. And in this conversation with Colin Hardman, Dietrich says he hopes the incident doesn't become a sign of what's to come.
I don't know if there's any way to anticipate whether these kinds of things are going to proliferate as we get closer to the election. It's really unfortunate that people feel emboldened enough that they can do this sort of stuff or that they even would have any motivation to do it. But really what happened last week, Illinois was, we were kind of fortunate because we received it on Friday. Other election offices around the country started getting them on Tuesday, became big news. So we pretty much knew it was coming and we had a fair idea of what the parameters would be, what the envelope might look like, what kind of writing might be on it, that sort of thing. So we knew it was coming. But it's not as if we're terrified because of these things, but it is just a little bit unnerving that this kind of thing is going on, especially in light of some of the real political violence that we've had over just this summer. So we are cautiously hopeful that this won't produce copycat kinds of schemes, but we won't be surprised if it keeps up and if it heats up more toward Election Day. But it's really, there isn't much precedent for this, so we really can't say whether we expect it to increase or decrease in frequency. We hope it decreases.
Sure. You mentioned a little bit there and also earlier during your talk, if I recall, that no one at the office was especially shaken by this. Apart from the kind of advance notice you had from other offices receiving something similar, are there other reasons why that is?
Well, they weren't shaken because we pretty much knew it was coming. But I will say that now I've been at this agency for several years. I started in 2018, so I've been through, you know, three election cycles so far. This is the second presidential cycle that I've been through. So I saw in 2020 how the rhetoric really heats up. And I think that those of us who were there through that 2020 cycle were really aware that things can get very heated and people can do some fairly crazy things. I will say that some of our newer employees who had just come on this year, on Friday, they were, you know, they thought it was a real eye-opener that, you know, this is not just something that happens somewhere else that you see in the news. It's something that they are in the center of. We also have in our office, we have a special device that scans the mail for potentially harmful things. Everything goes through that now. It wasn't that long ago that would have been unheard of in a state election office. Why would you need something like that? But that's the reality of what we're living in right now.
Touching on the recency of that, actually, I think anyone would agree that in any election, some people who had it go the way they wouldn't have preferred were going to call foul and say the election was cheated. Over the past few years, we've had a bit of a change in that. A major candidate has been echoing and forwarding those thoughts in many ways. Does that strike you as the main reason that these kind of threats and conspiracies have been emboldened recently?
Well, it's in the incident that we're talking about with the letter that we received, I have no idea what the motivations of those people were. And, you know, one of the things that the message that we've consistently tried to get out at the State Board of Elections is We know there are some people who have heard a lot of the talk about the rigged election of 2020, voting machines are somehow manipulated, all this kind of thing. We can fully understand how, even if someone who didn't give it any credibility just a few years ago, you hear it enough, you hear it repeated enough, you hear your friends talking about it, you might become a little curious about it. Despite the atmosphere that we're in now, where you have the letters like we received, and, you know, we've had two attempted assassinations during this cycle, tensions are somewhat high, but we don't want to add to that. And we're not going to be combative with people who may have beliefs about the election that we know to be untrue, but we want the chance to explain why it's untrue, why they can have faith in their elections, just like they always did in past years.
Sure. Now, on the topic of cybersecurity, mm-hmm. which was a major point in your talk tonight, one of the things I wanted to touch on was the idea that even if a hacker manages to breach a system that's not really consequential, that doesn't really allow them to influence the outcome, especially because balloting machines aren't internet connected,
correct?
The damage they can inflict is also undermining confidence in the election. It sounded almost like you were saying that can be even more threatening in some cases. Is that accurate?
Well, sure, because if people are not confident that their voter data is being held securely, then they're not going to register to vote. And they're not going to, consequently, they're not going to vote. They're not going to take part in the system. And the example that I always use is, even if the smallest county in Illinois, if that clerk's office on election day or the day before election day, if someone in that office accidentally clicks the wrong link in an email and opens up a malware attack that freezes up their county clerk's systems, it's going to become national news because that's an election office. And everyone's going to wonder, is Russia behind it? Is China behind it? Is Iran doing this? What about, is North Korea? What's happening here? Are votes being stolen? Are registrations being eliminated? All of these kind of things come into play, and they all come back to eroding voter confidence in the security of the overall election system.
That's Matt Dietrich from the Illinois State Board of Elections. He spoke with Colin Hardman. Dietrich says the Russians know U.S. election systems are almost impenetrable because it is so decentralized. So they try to influence elections through disinformation online to sow distrust and pit Americans against each other. For the past few years, a state review committee has been weighing changes to standardized testing. In the first of two reports, Peter Medlin explains the changes they've made and how teachers use test data to help students.
Which statement best describes what happens to the fruit drink mix when it dissolves in the water? A. The particles increase
in
size.
This is a practice question from the Illinois Assessment of Readiness, or IAR. It's the standardized test Illinois students from 3rd through 8th grade take every spring. Federal law mandates annual statewide assessments like the IAR and SAT, but what purpose do these standardized tests actually serve? That's one of the questions the state's Assessment Review Committee has been exploring over the past couple years, and I asked Illinois State Superintendent Tony Sanders.
I think if you talk to most school districts, they would tell you that the purpose of the SAT assessment and the IAR assessment really is just about accountability. Most districts do not utilize that test to inform classroom instruction.
Teachers use that test data a lot, though, and getting the results back to schools quicker was another issue for the review committee. This year, they did. Schools got the IAR results back before the end of the school year instead of in the summer. Tara Hammer is a third grade teacher at Carlson Elementary in Rockford, and she says it gives teachers more time to reflect and think about what skills they should be focusing more on.
It does affect what we teach before the test, and it does affect how we plan our instruction, especially in math.
The test is in April, and last year they saw a lot of questions about fractions on the test, so Hammer and fellow third grade teacher Sheila Zarosky say they got to make sure they focus on fractions before the IAR.
Have we addressed all the standards in ELA and in math by that April golden day?
We never make it. As hard as we try, we have never made it.
They can also see what kinds of questions their students struggled with and how difficult those questions were. Alyssa Campbell is a sixth grade math teacher at Clinton Rosette Middle School in DeKalb.
This is the first time I was able to sit down with students in conference and say, this is how you did on an IAR test. Way to go.
She says showing students how much they've grown gives the test more meaning.
I don't care if you're way down here as long as you're making growth. I don't care if you're way up here as long as you're not stopping there and still continuing to grow.
It allows them to set goals, but it still doesn't influence her classroom instruction. But there are other standardized tests that do impact her classroom instruction, like the Measures of Academic Progress or MAP test, which hundreds of Illinois schools take. They take MAP 3 times a year instead of just once, and they get that test data back immediately. It can be helpful information, but with the IAR, MAP, and other local tests, it adds up to a lot of assessments. MAP testing takes several days, and Campbell says the IAR is a week and a half of testing.
It's ironic because it's like you want us to teach the kids all this stuff so they can do well on the test, but then you're taking away our time to teach them to give them the test.
For the third graders, Zarosky says they spend even more time doing test prep because it's their first year taking the exam.
It does take a lot of teaching time out of the equation.
And both Rockford teachers say, especially for kids that young, the testing is exhausting.
We say, okay, well, this is the IAR week, so pretty much we're not going to be teaching much else because they're going to be drained.
I feel like the length of the tests sometimes are just way too much. They would be like, is it over yet? Is it over yet?
Campbell says accountability is important, but the testing is too much. And she says the most important thing is that people realize none of these tests are perfect indicators of how smart a student is or who they are.
There is so much more to being a successful student than being able to prove it on a test. Like, grades are a great component, or winning awards for being like the student of the month because you're showing kindness or responsibility.
Because teachers like her are in the classroom with those students every day, and they see students grow and succeed in ways tests will never be able to measure. I'm Peter Mudlin.
More on that story just ahead as we continue with Statewide. Stay right here. We're back on Statewide. I'm Sean Crawford. As we mentioned a moment ago, in the past few years, a state review committee has been considering changes to standardized testing. And in part two of his series, Peter Medlin reports on what changes they've made and how school districts use test data to help students.
A teacher heats 100 grams, G, of 3 different liquids.
This is a practice question from the Illinois Assessment of Readiness, or IAR. It's the standardized test Illinois students from 3rd through 8th grade take every spring. Federal law mandates annual statewide assessments like the IAR and SAT, and those scores make headlines.
About 35% of students between 3rd and 8th grade scored proficient in reading. This is all according to data.
It bothers State Superintendent Tony Sanders. He says it's misleading.
Illinois has the 4th most restrictive cut scores in the nation, meaning that we've set a standard higher than every other state, most every other state.
It's why he and the State Assessment Review Committee are tweaking those levels.
We need to right-size our standards so that we don't inadvertently tell a whole generation of students that they're failing when the evidence shows that they're not.
But how do school districts actually use the information they get from those tests? Is there data schools can get from standardized tests like the IAR that they can't get from more local assessments? Sanders says,
No, there's not.
Despite that, school districts do use standardized test data a lot. Jessica Nall is the coordinator of assessments for DeKalb Public Schools. It's her job to help schools understand data and use it to make decisions. She says they can use IAR data to reevaluate how they structure curriculum.
If we have an area like geometry, for example, that we know falls at the end of the curriculum in math, and then we see that our geometry scores aren't where we want them to be, we can have a broader conversation about how can we shuffle this so that we're not always running out of time to get to geometry.
Schools within the same district can learn from each other. If one did really well on a particular math standard, they can see if there are any lessons for the whole district. And they can also break it down narrowly to make sure specific student groups are performing well. Christina Miller is Rockford Public Schools' Director of Accountability, and she says they also compare themselves to other similar school districts. And she says they can use IAR data to evaluate if interventions are working. For example, last year, 20 RPS elementary schools extended the school day to focus on literacy.
Their data does look very promising. So there is some high-level recognition there about we used our extended time very well.
But administrators like Miller know that this data is not perfect. It's just one metric. And like we mentioned, high-stakes test scores often receive outsized attention. It doesn't tell you everything about a student. Sometimes they just find test-taking really stressful. It's what Miller found when talking to Rockford students who scored low on the IAR.
A lot of the students, they just didn't feel comfortable answering the question that they got a zero on these questions because they didn't even attempt, not because they don't have the skill or can answer the question, that their own confidence was an area of what the teacher needed to focus on.
Jessica Nall says the education system still clings to this idea that one number can tell the whole story of if a student or school is good or bad.
It's something that, as an educator, has bothered me for a long time because we've moved into this era of sort of extreme accountability, where we want to believe that there's any measure that can tell you exactly what the impact of a school or a teacher was.
Of course, there are tons of factors at play. Did you have a healthy breakfast the day of the test? Does your school have air conditioning? Did you have a good night's sleep? But sometimes people just see the score and compare it to other schools, even if they're very different. Christina Miller says that doesn't mean standardized tests are all bad or that local tests are all good, but overall, she does think that between the IAR, ACT, and other assessments, we test kids too much. Jessica Nall agrees.
Yes. I mean, think about how many tests we had to take when we were kids. I think it was one test a year, and we do a whole lot more now.
There will never be one perfect number that describes a student, a school, or a school district. And educators like Nall say schools need to strike a balance between collecting enough data to help students and hold themselves accountable without needlessly subjecting students to too many high-stakes tests. I'm Peter Medlin.
There are few issues that animate conservatives these days more than immigration and voter integrity. Bring those two issues together and you have a bill that a conservative lawmaker from central Illinois has proposed. Eric Stock reports on the plan that an immigration advocate says is unnecessary and harmful.
Dan Culkin's district includes much of rural eastern and southern McLean County. The three-term Republican lawmaker from Decatur won't be on the ballot in November. He's retiring. But Culkin says he's worried about other candidates whose names will be on the ballot and who will be casting those ballots.
If you have an organization that is going around, particularly going around these housing areas where we have these illegal aliens and registering them to vote, I think that makes it pretty obvious.
Is there any evidence that this is addressing something that's currently ongoing now in Illinois?
I think it is. Unfortunately, this isn't going to get even heard before this election. But, going forward, I think this is an issue that I would hope everybody is concerned about.
But is there evidence that is going on currently in Illinois where non-citizens are being registered and they're actively being sought to register?
I don't know the answer to that question. I guess, do you lock your house at night?
When pressed further about where ineligible voters are being signed up, Culkin cited Oregon, where several hundred non-citizens have been mistakenly registered to vote since 2021.
So if it's not happening, if people aren't involved in this, then what's the harm? Why not make it? Why not put the little teeth in it? Why not make a deterrent?
Voter fraud does happen, but cases are rare. The Heritage Foundation, a conservative think tank, tracks voter fraud across the country. It reports 20 improperly cast ballots in the U.S. this year. Many were for false registration, buying votes, or voting multiple times. All but four led to criminal convictions. Illinois has had one confirmed ballot fraud incident since 2019, a duplicate primary election voter in Macon County in 2022. Charlotte Alvarez is executive director of the Immigration Project, an agency based in Normal that offers services to immigrants across central and southern Illinois. Alvarez says she's talked with thousands of immigrants over the years, and she makes a point of asking all of them about voting.
When I ask clients if they've ever voted in a U.S. election, they have a very clear, oh no, we would never, response to that question. And sometimes people are even shocked that that could be something to be asked because it's just seen as something that's not a viable option for folks who are not citizens.
Alvarez says she's never heard a non-citizen share that they have voted. Those few cases we mentioned earlier haven't stopped some on the far right from claiming voter fraud, and attempts to commit voter fraud are rampant. Here are two examples on Fox News.
An illegal immigrant caught voting five times in the U.S. is sentenced to 8 years in prison. And
former President Obama's key advisor is heading up the operation of tasking our federal agencies to actually get votes from illegal immigrants.
Are you saying you have proof that the Democrats are trying to recruit illegals, migrants, to vote in our presidential election? Is that what you just said?
The voter integrity push gained steam in Illinois in July after the state started to issue driver's licenses for non-citizens who were granted temporary legal entry into the country. Illinois has a motor voter system where you are automatically registered to vote when you get your license, but it does not apply to non-citizens. The Illinois Secretary of State's office sent a letter to local election officers in early July to explain new safeguards they put in place to ensure only eligible U.S. citizens can vote. Skeptics argue that otherwise, there's no way to verify a voter's legal status, and they are correct. The head of elections in McLean County, Republican County Clerk Kathy Michael, says she hears lots of concerns from the public about the threat of illegal voting.
We're getting a lot of that right now, a lot of questions about that. Well, how do you know, Kathy, when they register to vote, they're a citizen? I said, because they tell us they are.
Anyone signing up to vote only needs to attest they are a U.S. citizen. That's it. The state does not require any identification, such as a driver's license, because that's long been considered a hindrance to voting, a so-called poll tax.
There's a box that they check on the registration form, and that's it. And I'm not being critical or otherwise. Personally, I think there should be more proof to prove you're a U.S. citizen now more than ever.
So it sounds like voter registration is all done on the honor system. Matt Dietrich, a spokesperson with the Illinois State Board of Elections, says not exactly.
There's a tremendous disincentive to a non-citizen who is in the United States to registering to vote and voting. And that is that if they are caught, they will be deported.
Dietrich says anyone who votes illegally, even by mistake, and later applies for citizenship or asylum or for a green card, immigration officers will check to see if they've ever voted or registered, and they will face felony charges and deportation. That takes us back to State Representative Dan Calkins' bill. It would make it a felony to knowingly help a non-citizen to cast a ballot illegally. Matt Dietrich with the State Board of Elections says he can't comment on pending legislation, but says there's already a law for that.
If they're knowingly out there trying to sign someone up, and if they are knowingly encouraging this person to commit voter fraud, which is knowing that they're not a U.S. citizen, is committing a federal crime.
Dietrich says that would be left to prosecutors to consider. He says there's also no evidence in Illinois that this is happening.
I'm not aware of any case where you've had a third-party group going out into the field, going door to door, and telling people, well,
just sign it. Don't worry. If you're not a citizen, go ahead and sign it, or they'll never catch. I've never heard of that happening.
The bill Calkins filed also calls for felony charges against any non-citizen who votes illegally. He says he plans to remove that from the bill since that's already a felony. Again, offenders are deported. Calkins called that an oversight.
And we failed to catch the part that about, you know, it's already a federal crime to vote. That was an oversight on my part and their part. Nobody actually caught that until the bill was drafted.
And Charlotte Alvarez with the Immigration Project says she'd prefer to see lawmakers spend their time addressing real problems. She says the proposal may create its own problem.
Legislation like this in an election year could have this dampening and chilling effect that would reduce voter participation and turnout of people who are eligible and able to vote. I think that's unfortunate.
Alvarez adds she's not aware of any organization targeting non-citizens for voter registration. I'm Eric Stock.
Representative Dan Calkins speaking with Eric Stock. Immigration is a central issue in the presidential race, and anti-immigrant rhetoric and misinformation is exacerbating long-standing tensions of scarce government services and job opportunities. But some groups are trying to change that in Chicago with dialogue sessions, especially between Black and Latino communities. Adriana Cardona-McGeegan went to a recent event aimed at bridging those divides.
First of all, good afternoon. Welcome to our space.
It's been a busy few months for Kevin Johnson. He's a young Black organizer with Working Family Solidarity who grew up in Englewood on the South Side.
Start these conversations, but two, hopefully being able to engage in these conversations as well.
He's been helping organize a series of community talks between Black and Latino residents called Racial Unity Dialogues.
We believe that by hosting these conversations in a safe space allows us to bring together what we describe it as peer unity and solidarity.
Johnson and other organizers say tensions among the two groups are being amplified by the recent influx of asylum seekers. About 48,000 have arrived in Chicago since 2022, fleeing political and economic instability in Venezuela and other Latin American countries. Some asylum seekers are eligible for temporary work permits if they can get them, but there are many who don't qualify and can't legally work in the U.S. The city and state have spent millions to provide them with food and shelter.
So for us to pile as many resources as we're doing as quickly as we're doing for new individuals coming in, I feel like morally is correct, but it's also systematically incorrect as well. I understand the pain and frustration.
Johnson understands that migrants are caught up in a situation that is out of their control.
And I think ultimately that it's up to our system to better handle immigration.
But not everyone sees it that way. Some Black residents keep voicing their frustrations at city council hearings about migrant assistance efforts.
Because how can this be that somebody just got in this country, has ownership, and I couldn't even get in a decent shelter? I can't even get housing.
People were angry, period.
Richard Wallace leads Equity and Transformation, an organization that advocates for Black workers in Chicago. He's also helping organize the Racial Unity Dialogues.
People were angry about the lack of resources in their community. People were angry about joblessness. People were angry about the cost of living that's skyrocketing. They have justified reasons to be angry.
But Wallace says the source of many residents' frustrations should not be the migrants. Instead, the historical lack of investment in Black communities. As the presidential elections get closer, migrants have been the target of false claims by former President Donald Trump and right-wing conservative groups. A big goal of the dialogues is to counter these claims, increase understanding, and change the narrative. At last week's event in Pilsen, Black and brown residents gathered, including people who immigrated years or decades ago.
Stay right there. We just switching it to the community conversation, so I'll be coming around with the mic.
And I think, yeah, we got cultural differences, but everybody can get their fair share of resources.
I think that we as a community, and whatever color we are, we have to union together so that our kids will know that it's okay.
Wallace says events like these also give residents a chance to talk about shared challenges and hear one another. Participant Melissa Warren agrees.
So it was very helpful towards me. I didn't know a lot of Hispanics and Latinos is actually going through the same thing as an African American.
Ana Vaca says, sometimes we're so caught up in our own worlds that we don't take the time to learn about other people and their struggles.
We're in a good spot. We got about 20, 30 minutes left. First, let's give all our...
There were no migrants at this particular dialogue, but organizers say their voices are welcome in future meetings. Wallace says unpacking the biases and the stereotypes on both sides brings people together, and that's the only way to create policies that will benefit all residents, regardless of when they arrived in Chicago. Adriana Cardona-Magigad, WBEC News.
We'll talk about political scams. That's ahead on Statewide. This is Statewide. I'm Sean Crawford. The Task Force of Illinois Lawmakers and Experts Studying Warehouse Safety, following a 2021 tornado in Edwardsville that killed six Amazon employees, has now entered its final phase of work. Will Bauer reports the group met for the final time this week.
After six meetings, state lawmakers, representatives from various industries, and the Department of Labor have heard from experts and a family of an employee killed in the tornado. Before the task force issues recommendations, they want to hear from the public. Republican State Senator Erica Harris of Glen Carbon says that will be essential.
If you have an opinion to share, please do it, because those will all be looked at and sorted through and will only help us make better decisions.
So far, experts have recommended improving structural requirements to warehouses, like mandating storm shelters or putting warehouses into higher construction standards like schools. The group will also consider improving disaster plans. The final report is due by the start of next year. In Edwardsville, I'm Will Bauer.
With the November general election less than 2 months away, emotions will run high in our polarized society. That leaves an opening for bad actors who look for ways to use people's passion to trick them. Brad Palmer, with member station WSIU, spoke about various political scams with the Better Business Bureau regional director, Sydney Waters.
The top reports that we're seeing right now associated with the election are phishing emails, phone scams, and text scams.
So how do you go about when you, if you get an unsolicited call or email, which these campaigns are allowed to do, how do you go about trying to figure out, is this legitimate or are they trying to pull something over on me?
So there's a few things you can do. The preventative measures that you can take, the very first thing you're going to want to do for anything you get associated with the campaign is to verify your sources. So don't ever click on a link that they send you from an unsolicited email or text, and always go to official websites by manually entering your URLs. And then what you can do after that is hover over hyperlinks to make sure they're legitimate and they match the campaign site as well. Also, just avoid giving out any personal information over the phone at all unless you're very, very certain of the source's legitimacy. Real campaigns may call you to conduct surveys or ask for donations, but scammers will use this tactic to steal your personal information, unfortunately. So if someone calls you and they ask you for very sensitive things like your social security number, your birth date, that's even something you shouldn't give out. Most people don't think that that would cause any issues, but that is a key component that scammers use to hack your identity, your credit card information. And then they also may have you do these surveys and give your credit card information in exchange for a prize for participating. So any phone call that, you know, offers you some sort of prize for participating in this questionnaire or this survey, that should be a huge red flag for you.
Now, there are so many different ways to vote now. You can obviously go to the polling place on election day. You can vote via mail. You can vote early at the courthouse, that sort of thing. If somebody says you can vote by text, that should obviously be a red flag, I would assume.
Yes. Yeah, so text your vote scam. So what we're seeing with that is scammers are telling people they can vote by text. And what that does is it actually causes them to miss the actual voting process. So they click that link to open and cast their vote. And what that does is it just downloads malware onto their device and hacks their identity, or it goes further To ask questions and gather that personal information as well. So any unsolicited link asking you to text by vote, just go ahead and go to the URL, check out, make sure you're using a legitimate site to cast your vote. No text voting.
Right. Yeah, that should definitely be a red flag. And there's even a possibility they may say we can register you to vote if you're not registered. That, how do you go about dealing with that?
Yeah, so that is definitely, no one will reach out to you unsolicited via text to register you to vote. So if anyone does that, just hang up the phone right away. Especially, in the next, this day, today, if you get anything like that, just go ahead and hang up. Another thing that we're really seeing is people saying that they need to just update your information as well. So they have pieces of your information, and you have to keep in mind that scammers actually do build profiles on you. So even if they can verify some components of your personal information, just be very wary of giving any additional. Verify your registration through official government sites, because no state allows phone-based voter registration. So if someone calls you to register you over the phone, and just the same as the text, go ahead and hang up and just assume that's a scam and contact the BBB.
So if you're targeted in any of these various ways, what are the things you should do to try and protect yourself?
You can always use our scam tracker and report scams. You can use that two ways. You can look up in your area and see what people in the community have been reporting before you go any further, and use that as a preventative tool. Or if you unfortunately do fall victim to a scam, you can use that to report that scam directly and let people in your community know what's going on. Another thing is, if you feel like something is off, it probably is. Most people have that gut feeling right away, and there's no need to, especially, on a very important time like election time, there's no need to take any chances. So if something feels off, take a moment, research, and verify through official channels. You don't have to do anything right away. So if something feels off, stop, hang up, contact us at the BBB, use us as a resource, and, just be preventative instead of trying to fix it later on.
Sydney Waters with the Better Business Bureau. It's estimated 8 million 18 and 19-year-olds will be eligible to vote this election for the first time. But young people can be daunted by the registration process, and historically, they have the lowest turnout of any age group. Jane Carlson tells us about a Galesburg High School senior working to change that.
A few months before Autumn Choma turned 18, she got online and tried to register to vote.
And it just said error, right? Like, it wasn't going through. They said they would email me in a couple of days with my voter registration confirmation. I just never got it.
So Choma went with her mom to the Knox County Courthouse and got the paperwork to fill out in person. But she says that is not something everyone her age would do.
That's a daunting process already, especially if you don't have parents who are going to encourage you in the first place to do it, or if you don't know where your birth certificate is or what documents you need.
So when Choma started her senior year this fall, she put a plan in action to make it easier for her peers to register to vote. She got in touch with Knox County Clerk Scott Erickson and worked with him to bring a voter registration booth to the high school during lunch on Tuesdays. Only some high school seniors will reach the milestone of being able to vote by November.
Scott Erickson also told me there's been pretty good interest from underclassmen coming up and just asking about the booth and what it means to register and kind of building that engagement young, which I think is also just as important as actually registering voters.
Choma wants to major in political science in college and maybe also dance. She says encouraging her peers to participate in democracy isn't about pushing them to vote for a particular candidate. She wants them to care and to have agency in their lives. And she knows her peers have opinions.
My generation has the firm beliefs. They just don't take it to the polls. If you have the beliefs and you're not voting on it, then you might as well stay silent. Your vote is your voice, and it matters.
Choma says she and some friends have also been directly approaching seniors and helping them figure out the process of registering to vote. I'm Jane Carlson.
Well, in October, chefs around Springfield will compete for the most votes in the second annual Vegan Chef Challenge. And Isabella Nieto spoke with the volunteer organizers Austin Simmons and Autumn Gwynn about the challenge. It's hosted by a group known as Vegan Outreach.
What kinds of dishes or alternate protein sources are usually found in vegan dishes?
Yeah, really a lot of things. So vegan foods, anything that's made without animals. So Meat, dairy, and eggs are the big things we try to avoid, but that still leaves a lot of stuff. So that can still be French fries, tortilla chips, Oreos. A lot of normal foods are already vegan, but the big thing is like the protein, and there's plenty of protein you can find from plant-based sources. But, you know, if you really want to make those dishes hearty, you can't just remove the meat. You need to replace it with something. So we'll typically use like, you know, tofu, tempeh. There's a lot of substitutes on the market, like Beyond Meat and Impossible Meat. And those are usually the dishes that do very well in the Vegan Chef Challenges when they incorporate those.
Can you tell me what tempeh is?
Ooh, that's a good question. Maybe Autumn can answer more on that.
It is fermented soybeans, kind of like in a brick, sort of like okay. It's kind of like halved soybeans. So, yeah, it's kind of like tofu, just not mashed up and processed.
Okay.
Yeah, it's very healthy, and it is interesting. If you like fermented foods, you'd probably like it.
Mm-hmm.
If you're on the fence like me, it's something that I need a good chef to do something with for me. Yeah. Like.
So why should people consider switching to a vegan diet? What are some of the benefits that you're seeing?
Yeah, there's a lot of benefits. For me, the biggest benefits to the animals, you know, just to make sure that, you know, I'm not the reason that, you know, any are being killed. But a lot of people are choosing more vegan options for a variety of reasons. Locally, a lot of people are interested in the health benefits. Vegans have a lower risk of type 2 diabetes, high blood pressure, and even about a 15% to 20% decreased risk in cancer. On top of that, too, there's a lot of environmental benefits, which I always really like. I grew up loving, you know, green energy and, you know, wanting to clean up litter and everything. And by going vegan, you're really cutting down your carbon footprint. Your diet requires far less land, water use, and a lot of different things.
Well, for me, I just feel like a lot more energy and just way more vibrant and everything. So,
what are some of the difficulties or barriers to adopting a vegan diet?
So living in Springfield and really anywhere rural, the biggest difficulty is familiarity and accessibility.
Yeah.
Because if you grow up, like I traveled to India, for example, and when you go there, every single product has a vegetarian label. It either says it is vegetarian or not vegetarian. So immediately you're going to know if there's meat in it. And even if you go to places like KFC, they have vegetarian options commonly. But here, we're just not used to seeing it. So a lot of people hear the word vegan, and they're in their mind, they're thinking like garden salads or, mm-hmm. you know, something that might not be very satisfying. So what we're trying to do with the Vegan Chef Challenge is show people it can be delicious, too. And it can be hearty. It can be filling.
What was participation like last year?
It was it really blew us away. There was 19 restaurants that ended up joining. All around town, and it was, I forget the exact vote total, but I think it was around 400 diners actually went through the voting link. They filled out the information there, and that could have mean hundreds or thousands of people would try these dishes. We got a lot of attention for it, and it was just really, the biggest thing that I like to see was a lot of non-vegans were really into it too.
And it brought a lot of business to local businesses. That was one of the biggest things we heard was they loved the increase of customers that we helped bring to them.
These chefs that are participating, what are we kind of looking for?
The ones that do really well go beyond just, you know, veganizing an existing menu option. Usually they're adding something that's not previously seen on the menu. So they'll be bringing in different ingredients and different flavors that you're not otherwise going to find. And that really makes it more appealing to the non-vegans, too.
What can the people who are trying all of these dishes, what can they expect as they're going through the voting process?
So there's a table tent that has a QR code on it and they can scan it. And then it's a little questionnaire of what they enjoyed, what they had and all that stuff. Mm-hmm. Pretty simple.
Yeah, and we encourage people to vote for every dish they try during the event. Some people will wait till the end and they forget everything. So at the restaurant or soon after, you can vote multiple times. And that kind of helps us, all that feedback, we try to get back to the chefs too. And that can help them decide what they want to keep on the menu permanently.
What advice would you give to someone who is considering becoming vegan?
I think it gets back to that verb we use, veganize. I think like the more you can learn how to veganize what you're already doing and eating. And I think because I was so willing to try so many different things early on, it really made it so I wasn't missing anything.
Yeah, really just finding what you like over time, because there's so many things you'll be like, eh, that wasn't good. But like, you find things that are like, this is amazing. And you can take it slow, or like, if you're that kind of person, you can go vegan overnight. That's cool. But like, for me, it was a transition thing. And so just take it slow and ease into it.
And forgive yourself. One day you'll order something you're almost 100% sure is vegan, and then you'll find out there's something in it. It's okay. You know, we still make mistakes, and it's not about being perfect.
Austin Simmons and Autumn Gwynn discussing this year's Vegan Chef Challenge in Springfield. They spoke with Isabella Nieto. We're out of time for this episode of Statewide. Thanks for joining us. Be with us again next time. We'll return with more reports and conversations from in and around Illinois. You can find us where you get your podcasts through the NPR app and at nprillinois.org. Crawford, Statewide is a production of NPR Illinois, with help from other Illinois Public Radio stations.